Hey there, conductors. If you've ever felt that you're not quite sure what to do next when you're studying a score, maybe you don't even know where to start with a difficult piece, maybe you study one piece too much and then you realize at the first rehearsal that you don't know another one well enough, or maybe you're a new conductor and you don't know what score study is, I'm excited to share that I'm finally publishing and sharing my score study checklist. I've been refining this for 12 years now, and I'm so excited to share it. It is going to walk you through my structure, my process to make sure that I learn every score that I need to learn well enough and so that nothing falls through the cracks. So it covers everything that you need to know. There's a link in the show notes. Go ahead and click it, sign up, and you'll get that score study checklist sent right to your email. You'll also get access to an 8-minute video of me explaining what each section is and how I use it to organize all the music that I need to learn. It's only 8 minutes, so it's not going to take you a whole hour to learn how to study better, how to put up a process for your score study, and how to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. So again, click the link in the show notes, and I hope to see you soon. Now, please enjoy this episode of Podium Time. Welcome to Podium Time, the podcast for conductors and students.
Because when you conduct at that high of a level, when you are that highly prepared, then any kind of advice or feedback, well, it'll make more sense and you will be more likely to receive it well. I've seen too many young conductors at workshops that either were a little ill-prepared and the advice kind of just went, you know, like right over their head, or they internalized everything the teacher had to say as an attack on them. I would say if you can find a way and let it be more of a, hey, here's where I am, this is what I have to offer, to be in that kind of mind frame, then you will get so much more out of the workshop. My name is Dr. Thomas Dickey, and I'm the Director of Orchestral Studies at Oklahoma State University. I'm in my second year in this position. And before that, for 5 years, I was Director of Orchestral Activities at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville and conductor of the Dubuque Symphony Youth Orchestra across the river in Dubuque, Iowa. And before that, I had a 1-year interim appointment at the University of Evansville and the Evansville Philharmonic Youth Orchestra. I got into conducting at a very early age. I was 16 years old when I conducted for the first time, and I thought that the sound of an orchestra was just the greatest thing I'd ever heard in my life, and I thought conducting an orchestra was the most incredible thing I'd experienced up till then, and that's when I knew for sure that I wanted to become a conductor. My career path has been almost entirely educational, climbing the university ladder, but also I've been very fortunate thus far to have a youth orchestra position, usually very nearby, either in the same town or not too far away. And I've been very lucky to have some guest conducting opportunities, be it with professional orchestras, all-state orchestras, honors orchestras, etc., along the way. You asked about competitions and workshops, and I am what I would call a workshop-aholic. At least I was when I was in graduate school. When I was a master's student at LSU and a doctoral student at the University of Georgia, I would say I averaged at least 3 masterclasses and competitions per year, if not more. I racked up a lot of debt in the process, but looking back on it, I wouldn't have changed it because it allowed me to conduct a lot of repertoire that I wasn't going to get to conduct at the universities. I got to study under a wide variety of teachers, and I learned a lot from everybody. Even if I didn't necessarily agree with them, I at least learned a different perspective about conducting. And I think most importantly, they were wonderful networking opportunities. You know, I've made some of my best friends through those workshops and competitions. I've also built a lot of connections and relationships over the years, because as we all know, the musician's world, but most especially the orchestral conductor's world, is very small. And it really is one of those things where who knows you, how well do they know you, and would they recommend you for something that could play a really important role in helping you get that next big opportunity. Or I've also found that I've gotten opportunities over the years primarily through networking. You know, people were recommending for things that I wasn't even applying for, wasn't even trying to get. And so I can't stress enough the importance of going to those workshops in competitions. When it comes to competitions, I will say that they are very competitive by nature. And so I would encourage everybody to apply to them, but not get discouraged if one doesn't get accepted to them. Just because, especially for the ones that take place in Europe, it's very hard for an American conductor, especially a young, less experienced American conductor, to even get invited to the first round, let alone advanced, very far. So one of the best pieces of advice that I ever got was from Mark Sedell, my mentor at the University of Georgia. He always said to me, "Thomas, you need to apply for everything because all you have to lose is postage." Of course, this was back in the day when, even when I was a DMA student, we still had to snail mail application materials. Of course, nowadays everything is entirely online, so now you don't even have postage to lose. You just have the time that it takes to send things. So, because what I think Mr. Sedell was stressing to that is you almost have nothing to lose, and it's really not your place to determine whether or not you think you are qualified for this workshop, for this competition, or even for this judge, because you really never know what the search committee or the people who are reviewing the materials are looking for. They might be looking for somebody who is younger, less experienced, but is more ambitious. They might be looking for somebody who's a little bit more, seasoned, a more veteran conductor, but you don't know that until you send in your materials. And so with my current grad students at OSU, with friends of mine who are grad students at other universities, I'm always saying apply, 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 because you'll never know how you're doing until you actually, send out your name, send out your resumes. And I know you didn't really ask about jobs, but I think it segues very nicely into that. And that is when it comes to, positions, I encourage everybody to apply for everything. No job is beneath anybody. Because the only way you're going to get feedback on how does my resume look, do I have good videos, how am I doing when it comes to interviewing and answering questions, is by applying and then hopefully getting those interviews. Because you just never know what opportunities are going to come your way. I know what opportunities won't come your way, and those are the ones that you don't apply for. So my best advice for young conductors is to be as ambitious and driven as you possibly can. Knock on every door because you just never know what's going to come.
And who are some of the who are some of the mentors you've had at the workshops that were particularly important in shaping who you are as a conductor now?
I think my two favorite workshop teachers, without a doubt, are Carl Topolo and Diane Whitry. What I loved about Carl Topolo, who unfortunately now is retiring from the Cleveland Institute of Music, is that there were, I think, 10 of us there at this particular master class. And each of us brought something very different to the podium. And when he would work with us, I remember him saying something along the lines of, "What you're doing is fine. It's not bad, but it's not great," was basically what he would say to us, is that it's not that what you're doing is terrible. I just think it could be better. And so he really treated us or approached us where we were and just helped us get to that next level. He wasn't trying to force any one pedagogical approach on us, like the Carl Topolo school. He would show us another way that, was just as effective, if not probably a lot more effective. Because he's such a wonderfully seasoned conductor. But I just appreciated that pedagogical approach of respecting what each of us brought to the podium, acknowledging that it had merit, but showing us a different way that might make us more successful. And Diane Whitry's approach was very similar. She would, let us get up there and conduct, point out what she thought was going really well, and then just show us a slightly different way that might make it even better. What I loved, though, also about her workshop, as far as I know, it's one of the few, if not the only one in the country, where it comes with like a resume critique, a video critique, and you do mock interviews and you do mock artistic planning committee sessions at this particular workshop. And so that was really beneficial for me as I was finishing up my doctorate, applying for jobs, and to have someone just rip my resume to shreds and say, "No, put this down here, move this up here, take this out entirely, reword it this way. Your video is starting at the wrong place. You need to flash forward 3 minutes in. You need to fade out there." I mean, at the same, at the moment, it was like, "Oh my gosh, I have the world's worst resume." But thank you for pointing that out, because now I left, or back then I left that workshop with a much better resume and a much better sense of what most likely the search committee was going to be looking for. And I credit Diane Wittry and that particular workshop and the resume video critique with being one of the main reasons I was able to get a job so soon upon finishing my doctorate. I'll always be in her debt. Same thing with Carl Topolo. I know for a fact that that very first job that I got, one of the search committee members was a friend of Carl Topolo's. Even though I didn't list Carl as a reference, I found out after the fact that my then boss called up Carl Topolo and said, "Hey, there's this guy named Thomas Dickey. He's a finalist for our job. And I see that he just studied with you back in March. What can you tell me about him?" Unfortunately, you know, Carl had very good things to say about me as a person, as a conductor. And, you know, that just stresses how small the musician's world is. I didn't list him as a reference, never would have thought to, but he knew my soon-to-be boss. And fortunately, you know, he had something nice to say about me. So those two experiences were really pivotal in terms of my development as a conductor and my transition into, you know, the real world, making money as a conductor, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
What are some of the problems or shortcomings that you see in education for music and conductors? And maybe one of them is that job search.
Yes. What I think is missing in most American graduate programs in orchestral conducting is a broader type of repertoire. I mean, yes, we all want to study the Mahler symphonies, Shostakovich symphonies, Strauss tone poems, but the odds are very good that your first job, maybe not even your second job, will be conducting an orchestra that can play those pieces. And something that I'm very grateful about the University of Georgia and other programs that are very similar is that they had campus orchestra, the non-majors orchestra, where you were doing, you know, not to raise our noses at them, but pieces like Ray Fun Williams' English Folk Song Suite and, you know, other pieces that I would say on a scale of 1 to 6 are a grade 3 or a grade 4, what we might think of more like youth orchestra pieces or community orchestra pieces. But to have the opportunity to study those pieces but also conduct those pieces really helped me to develop my what I call teacher chops, because most likely your first orchestra, whether it is a university position or not, you will have to wear an educator hat in some capacity, be it helping the strings with bowings and fingerings, clarifying articulations for winds and brass, etc. And knowing a wider variety of pieces outside of the standard canonical works that you study in the history sequence or symphonic literature classes, etc., will make you a more well-rounded conductor and probably would make you feel more confident applying for certain types of positions. But I think more importantly, it will help you become more successful in that first job that you get, be it with a youth orchestra or a small regional community orchestra, something like that. Having a wider variety of repertoire under your belt, but more importantly, knowing how to teach that wider variety of repertoire is a very valuable skill. And unfortunately, not all university graduate programs are able to offer students, you know, those experiences. I always encourage people when they're looking at graduate programs, make sure it is a school that will offer you more than one type of orchestral conducting experience. You know, you need to be able to conduct full orchestra, you need to be able to conduct string orchestra, opera orchestra, but I think you also need to be able to conduct the equivalent of non-majors or community orchestras or youth orchestras. And I am so grateful for those experiences that I had both at LSU and the University of Georgia to study and to get to conduct those non-standard canonical works.
Mm-hmm. So going back briefly, I wanted to ask before we got a little sidetracked. So for students that are preparing for these workshops this summer, doing their score study, preparing whatever they have to prepare for these workshops, what's some advice you would give them of, you know, looking back, things that you wish you would have done to prepare for workshops that you didn't?
Gotcha. I remember going to a number of workshops where the repertoire list was just like a mile long. And I just thought, oh my gosh, how am I possibly going to learn all that rep? And so I just, you know, that was my summer project, or like my late spring, early summer project. And then I showed up to the workshop and like, oh, we're really only going to focus on maybe movement one of this, movement two of that. We're going to skip that entire third piece. And I was like, oh my gosh, why did I, you know, but, you know, I don't trade, you know, any of those experiences. My best advice would be to prepare workshop repertoire as though it were with your own orchestra. And what I mean by that is you know it so well that when you get up on the podium for the first time, granted, it's with a group of strangers you've never met in front of a conducting teacher you probably have never met before, and you conduct it as though it's the performance. You know, you're not conducting as though you're seeing the score for the first time, because I think only when you are at that level, like performance level, then whatever suggestions and advices the conducting teacher is going to have to offer you, will it really make sense to you. If you are up there still figuring out when do the violins come in and how do you cue that, you know, entrance on the and of four, then you're really not going to take away anything from the workshop. And so I would say study the repertoire as thoroughly as you possibly can in however much time you have to prepare it. And when you're up there on the podium, treat it as though it's a performance. Somehow find a way to enter this mental state where this is my orchestra and we've been together for however many years and here we go with the concert. Because when you conduct at that high of a level, when you are that highly prepared, then any kind of advice or feedback that the teacher or the orchestral musicians might have to give you will be, well, it'll make more sense and you'll receive more, you will be more likely to receive it well. I've seen too many young conductors at workshops that either were a little ill prepared and the advice that the teacher had to offer kind of just went, you know, like right over their head, or they, you know, internalized everything the teacher had to say as an attack on them, which is very tempting because, you know, we're all artists, we're very sensitive people by nature. You know, to be a conductor is one of the most vulnerable things, and to have you stand in front of an orchestra and have people give you feedback could very easily be, you know, internalized as an attack on who you are as a person, as a musician, an artist, etc. But I would say if you can find a way to psychologically get past that and let it be more of a, hey, here's where I am, this is what I have to offer, what do you think, and how can you help me do it better? If you can allow yourself to be in that kind of mind frame, then you will get so much more out of the workshop and you will leave the workshop with a much more positive, lasting impression of it, as opposed to, oh my gosh, you know, the teacher thought I was the world's worst conductor and thought I had nothing to offer, or, you know, you could very easily walk away with it saying, oh, I completely disagree. Who does he or she think he or she is? I know more. And that's not the purpose of the masterclass, in my opinion. The purpose of it is to just get a different set of eyes, a different perspective on it from someone who has been in the business a lot longer than we have. There's nothing, you know, there are no ego and personal attacks going on, at least not the ones I've been to. was there a part B to that question, Luke? I can't remember. Or did I address everything?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it for that question.
I will throw out a slightly different like part B follow-up, and that is when it comes to the workshops, I would encourage everybody to do some very thorough investigating of who are the faculty, what is the repertoire, who's the orchestra, how long does it last, how much does it cost? Is it going to be videotaped for you? Do you have to provide your own video? Is there a concert at the end? Is it just like with piano, you know, four hands, etc.? Because you'll get different things out of different experiences. And I would say that if you are in a situation where you're not getting to conduct in concert on a regular basis, that maybe you need to go to a workshop where there is going to be that concert experience. If you are in a situation where you're conducting a lot of performances and you maybe just want to have a chance to work on more advanced rep with just like string quartet and you're not so, you know, worried about the video, then maybe that's the direction you should go. But I do think it is so important that no matter where you are in your stage as a conductor, you need to be acquiring the best possible videos that you can. And so if there's a workshop out there that has whatever famous Stravinsky excerpts or whatever big Appalachian Spring piece for you to conduct, and it's videoed and it's at a concert, that's a great one to go, because if you can get a great Stravinsky video, or if you can get a great Copland video, or a great concerto video, man, it's worth its weight, you know, in cost tenfold. If it's just standard repertoire with piano four hands, then maybe it's gonna be more just about, you know, technique study. So really figure out, what do you want to get out of it? What does that particular workshop have to offer? And is it gonna be a good fit for what you're hoping to get? I would never recommend going to a workshop just for the sake of going to the workshop. You know, go to one that you think is going to help you the most, and also the one that you can afford the most. That's also, without a doubt, very important, the cost factor.
So you've also done some workshops and stuff overseas. What kind of challenges did you have for anyone who's like potentially looking at an overseas workshop or competition? Was it substantially different from an American workshop? The conducting styles, were they... you know, were they vastly different? The teaching styles, like, what type of differences did you see in, you know, an overseas workshop, maybe in Europe?
Excellent. I will say that I have loved every one of my overseas opportunities that I've had thus far, because it really shows me how different the training is over in Europe for conductors. You know, the emphasis on solfege, piano, ear training, etc. And how, I mean, I love American conducting workshops, don't get me wrong, but I remember going to so many of them and, you know, getting very tired of focusing on this is how you hold it, this is how the wrist moves. And like, they were, many of them, trying to force one approach on all of us and turn like the 12 of us into like 12 clones. And then I go to Europe and it's like, they couldn't care less, you know, how I hold the baton, if I used a cork grip or if I had, you know, a wooden handle, if I didn't use the baton. They were more about, so how are you interpreting this piece and what gestures are you using to get that interpretation out of the orchestra? I'm yet to go to a European masterclass that got focused on the nitpicky stuff of like, is the, you know, does the wrist face down? Does the wrist face to the side? Is it a cork grip? Is it a wooden grip? You know, that was like minutia in their opinion. It was more about, so how well do you know this piece? How do you interpret the piece? Do you want to go into two? Do you want to go into four? But why? And how can you get into two? How can you get into four? And I've really appreciated that about my European experiences, that it really is more about, you know, the artistry, you know, and interpretation, and less about making the 12 of us who were there, you know, have one pedagogical approach, you know, kind of like shoved down our throat, so to speak. Now, granted, some of the workshops do have a pedagogy behind them, like the Mus and Technique or something like that. But there, they're just, you know, going to show you, well, this is how the Mus and school would teach this gesture. And this, you know, of the Mus and school, you might want to integrate this. Or if you did integrate it, this is how that gesture might then look. It was much more, you know, open-ended, throwing out other possibilities, much more about interpretation and artistry, and a lot of less about this is the way that it has to be done. And I will say, with the European ones, I've always appreciated that it was with full orchestra almost the entire time. You might have a morning session with piano forehand to prepare you for the afternoon session, or vice versa. But the amount of podium time with full orchestra, that's videoed and photographed at a very affordable cost, is outstanding, in my opinion. So I really appreciated those two aspects, the emphasis more on artistry interpretation and the amount of podium time you get in front of full orchestra, because there are so few workshops in America that are with full symphony orchestra that are at a very affordable cost, at least on a graduate school student scale, I would say.
Yeah. Are there any specific ones that are still going that you would suggest?
Well, I must say that anything that I recommend, I have not been paid to recommend them. It's based solely on my experience. The workshops that are organized through international conducting masterclasses, they tend to take place over in the Czech Republic, in like Olomouc and other places in the Czech Republic. Those are really well organized because they have somebody whose sole job is to screen the applications, set up the schedule, be your contact person. So just as an institution, it is very well organized. the orchestra played at a very high level and was very responsive to the different conductors who were there. And the teachers, they bring in a very wide variety of teachers, but at the same time, they're still open to artistry and interpretation, and it's not so much about this is the way you must hold the baton and this is the way you must conduct that piece. I really appreciated that one, and I will say, this one I just went to last summer, and I wish I could have gone to it like 10 years ago. European Musical Academy, it's primarily an opera conducting masterclass and competition for 2 weeks over in Prague. And that was just one of the greatest experiences I've had thus far, because as we all know, if you can conduct opera, you can conduct pretty much anything. And it was, especially with a lesser known opera, at least for me, I had never conducted The Bartered Bride. I was very familiar with the other opera that we focused on, Figaro. And so to see how opera comes together, to get to be a part of the rehearsals, to get to work with the singers, to work with the orchestra, that was a really very valuable experience. And what I will say, what I appreciated about that one, orchestra was very good, North Czech Philharmonic. Not many of them spoke English. And so it really forced us, at least the English-speaking conductors, to rely solely on technique, as because you couldn't stop them and say, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You had to show it. And so that was very humbling, even for me with a doctorate, with many years of college teaching experience, to really make sure that I am showing exactly what I want and not saying, well, I can show it sort of, kind of, because I can always just stop and clarify. No, there isn't going to be that option. You know, they don't speak English, or if they do, it's, you know, it's not at that high of a level. So I appreciate that. I appreciated that 2 week intensive experience of being immersed in opera and really forcing myself to make sure that every time I got on the podium, I was showing it as crystal clearly as I possibly could. I'll throw in one more thing. What I loved about both of those experiences is that the cost included not only the tuition, but also the accommodation. And so there was not much outside of out-of-pocket expenses other than the plane ticket. So it was a very affordable experience that I feel as though I learned a lot as, you know, as a conducting teacher. I learned a lot as a conductor. Great networking. I got great photos. I got great videos. And overall, it was just a really wonderful experience. So I wish that those had been around back when I was, you know, a master's student. You know, that was back before the recession, of course. But I can only imagine, you know, where I would be as a conductor if I had had that experience that I just had one or two summers ago, if I'd had it 10 years ago. But everything in due time, I suppose.
So kind of on this idea of things you might suggest to young conductors, what are some books or resources that you have found extremely helpful in, you know, your own personal education that maybe you encourage your students to read or go to?
Well, I mean, I was raised on the usual suspects, you know, Elizabeth Green, The Modern Conductor, also the Labuda book. I would also say that a very good book to have as a reference, you know, would be the Daniels Orchestral Music, which is now available online. I'm also a really big fan of Diane Wittrie's Beyond the Baton, What Every Conductor Needs to Know, because that's where all those, what I would call things we can't teach you in grad school, you'll learn only when you get a job, type of things are addressed. And so to be aware of those situations, and to get the different perspective of the different conductors that she interviews, like Spano, Slatkin, etc., that's a really good resource. I will confess that I tend not to read conducting textbooks. I'm reminded of a famous quote. I can't remember where I learned it, where I heard it, but it was great. And it was basically, reading about conducting is a lot like dancing about architecture. Technically, it can be done, but it doesn't make that much sense, or there's not much need to it. I should look up that quote to try to find its source. Because, yes, there are three ways to learn about conducting. You can read about it. You can watch somebody else do it. And then, of course, you get up there and do it yourself. And I have, you know, read most of the standard conducting textbooks, but I have just learned so much more by going to either workshops and competitions, attending open rehearsals by, you know, orchestras nearby, and then, of course, getting up there and conducting it myself. So, I mean, I would I probably should say, you know, I could rattle off a list of 10 recommended resources, but, you know, I part of me does think that reading about conducting is a lot like dancing about architecture. Yes, you can do it, but why? It makes so much more sense to, you know, watch somebody else do it and to actually get up there and do it yourself. Plus, you know, we're also at a time where even if you don't get accepted to whatever masterclass, chances are you can get on YouTube or you can get online and watch it either in real time or go back and watch it as it happened. And so to watch a great conducting teacher in action, I think, is just as valuable, if not more valuable, than reading the words of that great, you know, conducting teacher. But that's just my perspective, nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have any interests or habits outside of music?
Oh, boy. That's a good question. And I remember every now and then I get asked that on interviews. And so I always encourage young conductors to have an answer, whether you're stretching the truth or not. Because, yes, as conductors, we need to be well-rounded. We need to have that balance in time of, okay, the day is over or the work day is over, and I'm now going to have some me time, etc. But I will say at age 35, I still struggle with that. It is very difficult for me to stop working, to stop studying scores, to stop, you know, following things online related to the conducting field. But when I do find the time to stop doing that, I try to go hear actual professional orchestras nearby play, go to the opera. But I also have like guilty pleasures of, I love to go see movies, laugh out loud type of comedies sort of things. Like I said, that's pretty rare. I keep a really busy schedule that, you know, unfortunately, if friends say, hey, we should get together sometime, I half jokingly yet half truthfully say, great, I need 6 weeks notice, because my schedule tends to get that busy. I mean, I try to allow time every day for myself to go to the gym, you know, to work out. I think it's very important that we take care of ourselves, take care of our health and whatnot. And I have a handful of, you know, television programs that I like to watch at night. I won't name them because they're kind of like guilty pleasures that I'd be embarrassed if anybody else, you know, found out about them. But I do think it's important to have some sort of, you know, balance, even if it's just 30, 60 minutes a day where you're reading a book of fiction or you're watching whatever television program or watching Netflix, because it's so tempting for us as conductors to get soaked up into our own little world of music and we forget about, you know, all the things going on outside of us. I think it's also very important that we stay connected to, you know, what are our students being exposed to these days, or what are our audience members being exposed to these days? Because I think that sometimes influences the pieces that we choose for our concerts and why the pieces that we have chosen resonate with us and why they might resonate with our audience members. And then that consequently can influence, you know, if you're one of those conductors who likes to talk while on the podium, you share anecdotes of why particular pieces are meaningful to you and the connections, or are there any pop cultural references to these pieces, or where might people have already been exposed to them? And if you're not keeping up with, you know, pop culture, so to speak, then I think we start to get disconnected, you know, from our audiences, from our students, from our musicians, et cetera. But like I said earlier, I confess that I am really bad at making sure I have time for leisure activity and for non-conducting stuff. Check back with me in a couple years, you know, maybe after I'm tenured, I'll have more time. But for now, it really is, it's work, work, work. I know it's unhealthy. I own it. I confess. And I'm trying to get better. That's all I can say. I'm trying.
Oh, yeah. So one of my favorite questions, because kind of going back to not having hobbies outside of music, you know, because even when I'm not conducting, I'm still, you know, on YouTube finding random pieces that I've never heard before that I'm curious about. So what's kind of a piece that maybe, you know, you've discovered that you personally really enjoy that you would like to program one day to kind of get more exposure, that you wish more people would, you know about?
Yeah. I'm always, telling my grad students here at OSU about what I call your back pocket pieces. Like they're pieces that you keep in the back of your pocket that you're going to one day pull out that you know and maybe one other person knows, or they're not that frequently played, and they're actually really wonderful compositions and they're really successful pieces. And it can range from something like Borodin 2, or Chaik 2, which are wonderful compositions, not that frequently performed anymore. But I would say in terms of like actual off-the-beaten-path pieces, just this past Tuesday with my OSU orchestra, we did an all-Chaik program, and one of the pieces on there was a suite from the opera The Queen of Spades, which was compiled just back in 2012. And so I don't think most orchestras are programming it yet. And it's a wonderfully accessible composition. It's very Mozartian in style, yet it still has that Tchaikovsky twist to it. Parts are available for purchase. It's very accessible to orchestras of all calibers. And it was really well received by both the orchestra. The audience really seemed to like it. Looking forward to doing that again in a couple years. And then another piece that I discovered not too long ago that I will most likely be doing in November, also with OSU, is the Symphony in D by a Spanish composer whose name I'm probably going to pronounce it really, really badly. It's Juan Crisóstomo de Arriaga or something like that, who, when he was alive, he was considered the Spanish Mozart. He was born on the same day as Mozart, of course, not in the same year, lived a little bit after him, lived a short life, had a big output for such a limited number of years. And this symphony in D, the parts were made available, I think, just back in 2008. So they had been in obscurity for quite a while. And it's a wonderful 30-minute, four-movement composition that at times is very Mozartian. At times it's almost like proto-Beethovenian, etc. I've not conducted it before, haven't gotten the parts yet, but I'm looking forward to it. And another piece that I'm looking forward to that I've actually passed on to one of my grad students who will be doing it as part of his master's recital in the fall is the Rimsky-Korsakov Symphony No. 1 in E minor. The score is available for perusal on IMSLP, and then the parts are available for, I think, like $140. It's a nice four-movement work, about 25 minutes in duration, middle of the road in terms of difficulty, but it has those wonderful moments of like Russian angst with the wonderfully flowing Russian melodies. But in terms of technique for this, especially for the strings, very idiomatic, falls wonderfully under the fingers. It looks like a piece that, the students are going to really dive into. Like if you like Chaik 5 and pieces like that, but you need something a little bit, shorter and a little bit more accessible, this looks like a wonderful composition that I think once upon a time was very frequently played. And now, of course, most people don't know that Rimsky-Korsakov even wrote symphonies, yeah. Let alone, what's Symphony No. 1 in E minor. So I'm looking forward to my grad student conducting that in November. I'm looking forward to the Arriaga. Again, I apologize, probably pronouncing that wrong, in November as well. And I'm always on the lookout. Like you said, Luke, I'm always looking out for pieces that are off the beaten path, pieces that used to be popular, pieces that might be making a comeback. For example, I hope one day soon to conduct the Amy Beach Gaelic Symphony. Mm-hmm. Symphony in E minor, looking forward to doing that one day soon. Cost is a little bit prohibitive for my university orchestra budget, so might have to wait a little while for that one. I'm always on the lookout for pieces that were once popular, pieces that are coming back in popularity. And I will say I'm always looking for young up-and-coming composers who are interested in commissioning or doing a collaboration. And I'll make a little plug for one of my favorite living composers, Adam D. Odell, who writes wonderfully for orchestra, choir, voice, etc. He wrote a piece called To Dust for the OSU Symphony Orchestra. And it was very clever. He took my initials, TTD and OSU, and used that as a musical cryptogram for the melody. And then he used Morse code for TTD and OSU as the basis of the rhythm. And so it had a lot of like 11-8, 15-8, 7-8, you name it, and a lot of extended tertian harmonies. And it came together for a really, really cool composition. And of course, you know, Adam, you know, cut us a great deal on the price and came down for 3 days and, you know, did composition lessons and master classes with students at OSU. And so I'm always on the outlook for, you know, young up and coming composers like Adam, who clearly have a voice, who are clearly writing very well for orchestra, who are looking for a little bit more exposure, who are open to, you know, a conductor saying, here are the parameters where I need it to be, you know, 5 minutes, please don't go above seventh position in the violins, or please don't, you know, have more than five flats, or whatever the case may be, who are open to those parameters, or like nothing too outside the box in terms of extended technique. Always looking for young composers who are, you know, looking for opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Hey, when you said Dubuque earlier, I was going to ask if you know Adam.
Absolutely. I got to work with Adam. He wrote a piece for my youth orchestra, Black Hills Overture. That was a really fun piece. And then I also got to work with Luke Flynn. We did his Larghetto for string orchestra. And that was a really, really cool composition. Not quite like a Barbara Adagio, but it goes into that, you know, really extended string Debussy, starts out, you know, slowly and softly, you know, and builds in intensity. Really cool composition, writes well for strings, falls under the fingers pretty well. Yeah, those are two really good friends of mine who are going on to incredibly successful things.
So is your process for preparing yourself to rehearse a new piece that's never been done before, is your process any different than, you know, preparing a Beethoven symphony?
Yes, actually, because, you know, there's almost no listening time, because if no one's made a recording of it yet, it's up to me to figure out how I want it to sound or how might it sound. And so then I'll really spend a lot more time at the piano, plunking out the lines, doing a lot more solfege, trying to hear it different ways inside my head. So I wouldn't say that I know the piece any better. I'm just less familiar with the traditional interpretations, because if it's like that Tchaikovsky Queen of Spades suite, I found almost no recordings out there. So I couldn't come to the orchestra and say, well, so-and-so's tempo marking was this, or in this bar, several people tend to stretch or several people tend to push, because I had nothing to reference. I could only say, this is how I hear it, you know, and I'm not saying that this is the new definitive interpretation, but I just had to tell my students, based on my study, based on how I understand how this piece comes together, this is how I'm going to approach it. And so in some respects, that was really very cool, because there was almost no one to say, are you off your rocker? No one does it that way, because, you know, no one could come back and say, that's not the way it's done. But at the same time, it was very terrifying, because I was putting myself out there saying, I think that this is a very valid interpretation that might be followed by other people, especially like if I put the recording out there on YouTube, and I'm putting myself out there in a very vulnerable way for people to, you know, criticize my interpretation and say, oh my gosh, you know, Thomas, your tempo was so slow, or you were, you know, so fast by 20 clicks, or why didn't you stretch that one phrase, or you really should have added, you know, poco poco agitato. By the same time, I'm totally willing to do that, because, you know, someone's got to get these pieces out there and say, hey, I discovered this piece. I think it's cool. And I think this is my interpretation. And here's why. So it's exciting in some respects, terrifying in other respects. But in terms of my preparation, it was no different than I would prepare a Beethoven symphony. I was just missing that standard, you know, set of interpretation. Of course, you know, I don't have any books that I can go to that, you know, offer the various critiques and offer the various metronome markings and so forth. But at the same time, it was kind of liberating, because then I was, you know, suddenly able to come up with, what do I think are the appropriate metronome markings? What do I think are some possible interpretations? And we go from there.
Yeah. So Our last question that we'd like to ask our guests is kind of just like a, you know, a good closing question. If you had to put something on a billboard that musicians would have to see every day, that every musician would see every day, what would you put on there? It doesn't have to be a quote. It could be, we've had people say, like a manuscript or a movie. It could be anything. But what do you think you would put on a board that the musician would see every day?
That's an excellent question. I would want there to be a billboard that very concisely reminds musicians why we do what we do, and that is to bring about change, you know, to move people to affect lives. Because I really believed to the core of my being that to be a good conductor, to be a good musician, means to put ourselves at the service of others, at the service of the art, you know, to not make it about ourselves, and to remind us that why we do what we do ideally is to bring about change, to either to bring people together, to move people, to affect them in some capacity. And even if we move just one person at that concert, if they somehow have an emotional response, or if they, you know, like, vibrate sympathetically, so to speak, then we've done our job, because we just never know who is out in the audience. We never know what kind of day they've had, what they're going through, and how that music might relate to them. If I had a dollar for every time I've had an email waiting for me the next morning from somebody who came to the concert and wrote a wonderful note, you know, thanking me for the music and letting me know what that piece meant to them, and how either, like, they had been grieving the loss of a loved one and something about the slow movement made them cry but smile, or I gave them, you know, peace and closure, or they've been having a really bad day and the upbeat finale just reinvigorated them and gave them, you know, great gusto and charge to go into the next day, you know, my student loans would be paid off probably. And those emails always just knock me over like a feather every time. I never cease to be just stunned at how powerful music really is. And I think it is so tempting for us, especially as conductors, to get caught up in the business aspect of it and the competitive aspect of it, and to forget why we got in this business in the first place. And that is to bring together, you know, the orchestra, to bring alive a composition that may have been written yesterday or 100 to 200 years ago, and to bring together people from all over the city, the state, the country, or watching online, to bring them together and somehow create some experience for them that is greater than all of us put together, an experience that transcends words, and hopefully will resonate with them, will connect with them, will move them in some capacity. And I think we need to be reminded of that every day. It shouldn't be just on a billboard. I think it should be like on our refrigerator magnets. It should be on our bathroom mirror, that we see it every time we pass it, of like why we're doing what we're doing. Because it's just when we do remind ourselves of it, I think we come back to it so much more refreshed, so much more renewed, reinvigorated, and we approach the music from a whole other perspective when we are reminded that all of this is for something that is bigger than ourselves and for something that, you know, can't be described with in words. So I'd want there to be a big billboard that reminds people that we're changing lives, we're bringing people together, and it's about the art, it's not about us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Podium Time. You can find show notes for this episode and all of our other episodes at podiumtimepod.wordpress.com. Be sure to join our mailing list there or on our Facebook page at facebook.com/podiumtimepod. Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony was performed by the Czech National Symphony Orchestra, and Beethoven's Egmont Overture was performed by Stefano Ligorati.